Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Daniel Byman, who is Director of Research at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, where he focuses on counterterrorism and Middle East security. He's also a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program and served as a staff member on the 9/11 Commission. His new book just out is A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Byman.
Thank you for having me.
And this week, of course, the United States, the White House counterterrorism czar announced a new counterterrorism strategy. And we've always assumed here in the United States that the Israelis are the ones to emulate. They're the best at it. What's your sense, given all the work you've done in terms of your new book?
The Israelis are both worthy of emulation and also teach us lessons of what to avoid. The Israelis are really good at gathering intelligence. They're really good at military operations against terrorists. But they often think in the short term, and they need work on developing long-term approaches to counterterrorism.
Well, Israel is unique politically in the extent to which senior intelligence officials sort of rotate back as senior politicians. Tzipi Livni, the head of Kadima, being an example of a Mossad senior operations officer with the Mossad, now head of a political party. I don't think here in the United States there'd be any equivalent. But what seems to be happening now in Israel is that a number of senior intelligence officials are going public and lambasting the sitting government and warning the Israeli people that that Netanyahu is likely to attack Iran. And this is not just the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, but former head of military intelligence, the former head of Shin Bet. They're all weighing in. So what's happening there in Israel?
There's a real distrust in Israel between the senior security officials and the Netanyahu government. A number of them see him as someone who is far more political than they would like, someone who is willing to do quite risky things like attack Iran. They're worried that he would do it in part to shore up his political stature rather than because it's the right thing to do.
And what's your sense of that?
In my view, an Israeli attack on Iran would be a huge mistake. Should Israel attack, there's a real question as to how effective the operation would be and whether it would truly set the Iranians back more than a short period of time. But also the Iranians could retaliate. And unfortunately for the United States, it's easier for the Iranians to retaliate next door in Iraq in particular and also in Afghanistan. And so the United States might bear some of the burden for an Israeli strike.
Well, presumably the United States has let Netanyahu know, wouldn't you think?
I think there's no doubt on that. Certainly under President Bush, Secretary of Defense Gates made it clear to the Israelis that this was not something the United States favored. And my understanding is the Obama administration is even more skeptical. So clearly the Israelis know. But Israel has always made it clear that it will act in its own interests. And this is something American leaders are aware of.
So, Daniel Byman, I understand that what is exacerbating this insecurity in Israel, where as we're discussing, the military and intelligence people are skeptical of the government and feel that the Prime Minister Netanyahu might do something militarily that's rash for political reasons. Now, what apparently is weighing on the political establishment in Israel is this ticking clock with the Palestinians declaring statehood through the United Nations. And that was the assumption that on the part of Maya Dagan to go public. How does that fit into this mix?
The Palestinian decision to go before the UN and get UN General Assembly approval to be a state is something that has worried Israelis quite a bit. They're concerned that this will further legitimate the Palestinians. It will increasingly isolate Israel. In part, I think this is an overreaction. One thing I ask Palestinian officials is, okay, having declared a state, how does this change the situation on the ground in October after such a declaration? And the real answer is not much. But symbolically, it's very important. It's a way that the Palestinians are trying to really keep pressure on Israel, and Israel doesn't have a response because there isn't a robust peace process. There isn't a way for Israel to say, you should use this alternative or this alternative. So Israel correctly feels that it's being bypassed and will look bad as a result.
But as you point out in your new book, A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism, Daniel Bimon, is that paradoxically the Israelis depend upon the Palestinian security forces on the West Bank to do much of the heavy lifting in counterterrorism. And now Israel's basically saying the deal that that Fatah's made with, the Palestinian authorities made with Hamas, they're not going to support that. And essentially, all bets could be off, couldn't they?
That's one of the great ironies, is today keeping Israel safe from terrorism depends on Palestinian officials, especially in the West Bank. And should relations sour between the more moderate Palestinian officials and Israel, it can certainly make the situation less secure for Israel. Now, Palestinian officials, President Abbas, Prime Minister Fayyad, they're cracking down on groups like Hamas, and they have in the past, because they see them as rivals. It's in their own interest. But with the unity agreement with Hamas, there's going to be real pressure on the moderates to not act. And if there is no peace deal that's ongoing, it's going to be harder and harder for Israel to put pressure on the moderates to say, you have to do this, because Israel will have less leverage.
But in the broader context of the Arab Spring, it seems that the Netanyahu government is sort of somewhat flat-footed and maybe out of touch with history here. They're not welcoming these changes. They're actually afraid of these changes.
Early on, the Israeli reaction to the Arab Spring was that this is more likely to be Tehran in 1979 than Prague, say, after the end of the Cold War. And there was a real fear that these revolutions would lead to an Islamist takeover, or could lead to chaos. And as we all know, the verdict is still out on what's going to happen in Egypt and Tunisia or Syria, for that matter. But Israelis point out that they've made peace successfully with two governments, the government of Jordan and Egypt under Anwar Sadat. And both of these were dictatorships. So for Israel, having a more democratic government come in or instability does not necessarily mean peace is more likely.
But in terms of the sweep of history, you would think that Israel, being the only democracy in the Middle East, could position itself as a mentor rather than an opponent.
That would be the hope, although I think, unfortunately, that's unrealistic. Israel's popularity rating among Arab states is incredibly low, and that's among democratic forces as well as among Islamists or supporters of the old regime. So even if Israel has lessons to offer, I don't think anyone in the Arab world is likely to listen.
And my understanding that in Israel itself, there's more and more of a siege mentality developing, isn't there, as they lose Mubarak and as the King of Jordan. I wouldn't say shaky, but at least, there's some rumblings there. Is that what you observe?
That's right. Israel has looked to these Arab dictators and seen them as potential friends. They're moderate in their policy towards Israel. And Israelis' concern is that if a government comes in Egypt, say, that truly reflects popular opinion, that government is going to be a lot more hostile to Israel just because the ordinary Egyptian is much more hostile to Israel than was Mubarak.
And how is this translating, though, in terms of Israel's politics? Because I noticed that relatively recently, actually maybe 6 months ago it was, former President Clinton mentioned that Israel's one of the reasons why peace was less and less attainable, or that we had a peace process as opposed to peace, was that the Israeli political center was moving to the right, and Clinton attributed that to the Russian emigres. So has Israel become not just more of a siege mentality, but also more of a kind of right-wing bastion?
I think that's correct. There are disputes as to why this is so, but clearly the political center of Israel has moved to the right. In many ways, the biggest challenge to Prime Minister Netanyahu is not the traditional Labor Party or even the center-of-the-road Kadima Party, but forces on his own right. So when he's thinking about making a deal, he's thinking that it could hurt him with his conservative base. And so he's very, very cautious about anything that could alienate them.
Well, my understanding, Daniel Bowman, is that forces on his right are right at home. His own father, apparently, thinks his son's a liberal.
That's exactly, I think you're actually quite right on that, that this is, well, I'll just simply say that Israel has moved fairly steadily to the right, and there are a lot of reasons for that, some societal and some, I think, because of Israel's negative experience with peace talks and the second intifada after that. And this has, unfortunately, makes it much more difficult for a peace deal to be achieved.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Bowman, who is professor at Georgetown University and the author of this new book, A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. And the book talks about the Battle of Jenin and why that was a turning point in Israel's counterterrorism efforts. Explain that, if you would, Daniel.
The Jenin operation is part of a broader military operation where Israel reoccupies much of the West Bank, and this occurs really near the height of the Second Intifada. Before Jenin, Israel had a very hard time getting intelligence in the West Bank, and even when it got intelligence, it often wasn't able to act on it because it couldn't move quickly enough. When it tried to arrest someone, they simply moved before Israeli forces could arrive. After Israel goes into Jenin and goes into other places in the West Bank, there's tremendous criticism. It's, in so doing, it's essentially said, peace talks are over. We're not going to respect the autonomy that the Palestinians were granted. And the Jenin and other operations at times are quite bloody. And so Israel's widely criticized. But over time, this is a tremendously effective counterterrorism operation. By having forces on the ground, Israel is able to gather a massive amount of intelligence. It's able to detain many suspects, which produces even more intelligence. And by establishing checkpoints, by creating a military presence on the ground, it can move very quickly and do arrests and target killings quite rapidly. This sort of operation, however, is very costly for Israel politically. The United States at first is critical, and around the world, of course, there's tremendous criticism of Israel for reoccupying the West Bank. And this is really a theme of my book, which is some of Israel's most effective measures from a counterterrorism point of view are also quite costly politically and especially to the Palestinians who are affected by this. So there are really sharp trade-offs, unfortunately.
Well, but clearly, subsequent to that, the Gaza siege and then the flotilla, the Turkish flotilla, where Israel came into enormous international or provoked enormous international outrage on both accounts. Can you make that argument there that there was any value in terms of counterterrorism?
The flotilla was part of stopping the flotilla was part of the broader effort to keep Gaza isolated, to prevent things going in and out of Gaza without Israeli approval. But it was a disaster from a public relations point of view. Israel looked both cruel and incompetent, and that's an extremely dangerous combination. And as a result, groups like Hamas took heart. They believed that they could end their isolation through embarrassing the Israelis, through international pressure that would force the Israelis to make changes. So when Israel does this sort of isolation, it often doesn't factor in international opinion and how it's going to look in the media, and then is sent reeling when it turns out there's quite a negative reaction. And this is something Israel needs to do better on.
Well, clearly they have a second chance, if you will, if this flotilla materializes. This new flotilla, which may have been sabotaged, but I think something's going to show up soon. So
How Israel handles the new flotilla is going to be very interesting, because do they recognize the power of the media? Do they recognize that they need images that show that Israel is responsive to the human situation in Gaza, even as it tries to enforce a degree of a blockade for security reasons? And this is particularly important because of the Arab Spring today. Israel, for the most part, has not been an issue in the Arab Spring, but high-profile issues like the flotilla have the potential to bring Israel into this, and perhaps in quite a negative way. Perhaps the flotilla will divert attention on Israel, and as a result, there'll be a waning of attention on the need for shoring up democratic institutions.
Well, what about the Gaza incident? Wasn't that a catastrophe? I'm just curious to know whether there was any gains in terms of counterterrorism there, as opposed to the amount of outrage that it generated around the world.
When Israel went into Gaza in 2008, and this continued into operations continued into 2009, the devastation was considerable. There was devastation to Gaza's infrastructure. In addition, while many Hamas people died, so too did many civilians. The outrage still lingers today, and Israel is paying the price. Israel is increasingly unpopular, and its legitimacy is questioned. However, many Israelis believe this was a tremendous success. Hamas had been launching rockets on a fairly regular basis before this operation, and while there had been a ceasefire, it had commenced again to launch rockets right before the operation began. After the operation ended, Hamas's rockets really diminished. We see a huge change in late 2009 after the operation when you compare it to, say, 2007. And so Israelis believe that while their use of force was quite heavy, it served the ends of deterrence, that they scared Hamas, and that Hamas doesn't want a second round. So their view was the heavy use of force was productive in reducing the number of rocket attacks.
Well, if you could give me a quick 30-second answer here, the other accusation by the former head of Mossad was that Netanyahu blew the opportunity the Saudis offered for a comprehensive peace deal. Do you think that was a disaster?
The Saudi offer was many years ago, but there's a real question, which is there a possibility of bringing the Arab states on board as well as the Palestinians? And the idea is they would reinforce each other. The Arab states would give the Palestinians political support, and if the Palestinians bought it, it would enable the Arab states to be more moderate to Israel. In my view, the Saudi offer was quite dramatic. Saudi Arabia, of course, always very hostile to Israel, and has tries to promote strong Islamist credentials. So if Saudi Arabia could be on board as a potential partner for peace, that's quite an accomplishment. There would be a lot to do, though. The Saudi position was quite far from the Israeli position, but to me it's something that should have been pursued more aggressively.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Daniel Barman.
Thank you for having me.
Again, Daniel Barman is a professor at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service and is the author of a new book, A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. And I would like to invite you all to the UCLA Hammer Forum this next Wednesday, July the 6th. I'll be conducting a Hammer Forum called After the Arab Spring, where we'll be speaking with Dr. Rabab El-Mahdi and Jawad Nabulsi, both of them very important organizers in the Egyptian Revolution. And, of course, it's very important now to talk about where it stands after the revolution. And, again, that'll be July the 6th. At the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood. It's free and open to the public, so I hope you can join me for this important discussion. And next week I'll be taking off after the 4th. My guest host on the following Tuesday, the 5th of July, will be Tom Hayden, and there'll be other guest hosts on the Wednesday and the Thursday, and I'll be back on the following Sunday. So I hope you can... I hope you enjoy the programs. Come to the Hammer Forum on the 6th, and I'll be back on the following Sunday. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our production intern is Graham Fitzgibbon. Our theme music is by Los Lobos, and you can check it out at ianmasters.com. Again, I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Still the same. My father said to time one night in America. Time one.